1, 2, 3, 4.
We don't need to find an end solution, but it's a space where we can speculate, we can imagine, we can practice our foresight. We can be part of a bigger collective imagination together with an institutional framework, which is really what we try to motivate as well when we communicate these exhibitions to our audience and speak with our guests about these works. We can also sense that it's really a place where a lot of people like to enter these days. You know, when you turn on the TV or look at a newspaper or listen to your radio and speak with your friends, it seems like the world is falling apart on so many levels. It's such a challenging time. So I think we can also offer this space for reflection, but also hopefully a reflection that gives some idea or some feeling of agency. So I think we can really give that space to our audiences by showing some of these groundbreaking practices that are out there right now in contemporary art. I think for me, it's this awe that I have every time I meet an artist who has the courage to deal with what it means to be in the world as a human being and to tackle from different ways through different media. I always feel that through the collaborations I have with artists, I learn a little bit more about the world, about myself, about my feelings or emotions or how I reflect about things. Getting another person's perspective, taking that in. I think it's extremely generous, actually, what we can take with us from the artistic practices that we meet. And again, I think one of the fundamental importance about art is that it's not a place where we need to agree or find consensus or have rules. It's a place where we can speculate, where we can imagine, and hopefully re-courage ourselves in a way, if that's a word. But yeah, I'm always motivated by working with artists. It's that personal meet that's always extremely fruitful.
In the ever-evolving world of contemporary art, some voices rise to shape the conversation in truly profound ways. My next guest has spent her career at the nexus of institutional leadership, curatorial innovation, and artistic collaboration. As the director of the Arken Museum of Contemporary Art in Denmark, she is not just leading a museum, she's rethinking its very purpose, from an artistic lab to a public town square. Her journey has taken her from the hallowed halls of the Tate and Arras to the forward-thinking spaces of Copenhagen Contemporary, all while championing the freedom of artists and the civic role of the museum. It is a great privilege to welcome the director of Arken Museum, Marie Nipper. Welcome to the creative process, Marie.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
So you've had this remarkable trajectory from Arras to Tate Liverpool and then to Copenhagen Contemporary and now to Arken. You know, what was the through line? How do you see the institutional DNA of each place informing the next chapter of your curatorial practice and now your vision for the museum?
I guess that's something you always see in retrospect, right? The different points that seem to outline my career and the different positions I've had. But Arras was my first real job in an institution. I started in 2004, and at the time the museum wasn't even open to the public yet. So it was this brand new institution opening in Aarhus, which is the second biggest city in Denmark. And it was a museum really built for contemporary art because it moved out of its previous location because it was just becoming too small. The spaces were too small to show the formats of contemporary art as they were developing at that time. So I think I kind of got this first encounter with an institution that was really trying to rethink itself, that was trying to work with the new agendas within contemporary art, the new formats that were also trying to speak to audiences in a new way and kind of, in a way, reform the way institutions had been working before, or that particular institution, which has more than 100 years in its history. And so I was kind of a part of a period in time for that institution, which was super exciting because we were trying new exhibition formats. We were introducing artists to a Danish audience that had never been shown before. Arras has a historical collection, but it was also very much about introducing contemporary art to a Danish and Nordic audience. I think it was extremely formative for me to start off my career, you can say there. I started as a tour guide and ended up as the chief curator and the manager of the curatorial and learning department. So it was also this kind of progression in terms of myself as a professional person, stepping into managerial roles and taking on leadership of an institution. And at a point, after about 10 years, I had the wish to also get a more international perspective on the institutional workings. So I started at Tate Liverpool, first as senior curator, and after that as interim artistic director. And it was extremely important for me also to have that international outlook, of course, but also to investigate the practices outside of Denmark. How did an institution such as Tate work with the collection, with acquisitions, exhibitions, but especially also the learning and the community work that Tate was doing? For me, that was something where I could definitely see the UK museums being quite ahead of the Danish institutions in terms of engaging communities in the workings of the museum. On the other hand, I also saw that especially Aarhus, where I came from, we were a bit more daring when it came to the exhibitions and the staging of the exhibitions. And we were very much engaged with this experience part of going to a museum. So I think it also came and brought this maybe a bit Scandinavian, maybe a bit, you know, different way of thinking engagement, which is for me something you do by community work, by outreach, but also by the way you do your hospitality in an institution, by the way you accommodate people when they come in and the audiences, how you take them through your exhibitions. And I think that was the learning I had at Tate, that was a very important aspect for me, that how could we as institutions be the best hosts possible for audiences who might not be accustomed to visit museums and even less accustomed with contemporary art, which for some could be just by the name contemporary art, could be something, you know, that was inapproachable or difficult to engage with. So I thought it was a great opportunity when I was asked to come back to Denmark to open this new institution, Copenhagen Contemporary, which is a Kunsthalle type institution who at the time did not have a collection, but was to open in an old shipyard in kind of the outskirts of Copenhagen. Well, very close to the center, but at the time, an area which had not been gentrified or developed, so an old industrial area of Copenhagen. And for me, that was a fantastic opportunity because I think what I also came to realize at the time, my big motivation for my work is trying to add to the innovation of institutions, of artistical practices. It's to push the boundaries of the institution to either be the one who can initiate or to contribute to a development in terms of trying out new ideas, to try to be a relevant institution in today's world. So this offer of starting an institution from scratch was super exciting because it was like an entrepreneurial atmosphere we had for the first couple of years. You know, of course, everything was extremely complicated. We had these huge spaces we needed to fill with art. So we needed to figure out how do we do this with this small team that we had. We had to figure out the finances. We were not state funded or funded by the municipality as many institutions in Denmark are. So there was also this entire new way of thinking a financial structure. And also, how did we want to engage with the audience and the communities? Because we were in a part of Copenhagen that wasn't really developed yet. But it was really, really fun. And we kind of had the spirit of, we try stuff out. If you want to change, we'll change it. We can do it next week, we can do it tomorrow, which is really atypical for institutional practices, you know, especially museums are kind of these big ships that take years to turn around. And if you want to change organizational structures or way of working, it's really a lot of work and it takes time. And that kind of dynamic, that agility that we had at Copenhagen Contemporary, I think was extremely exciting. And also for the audience, because I think that if you've, as an institution, have that courage and that nerve, I think it really kind of rubs off on the experience you give the audience. Then I was offered to come to Arken in 2022, so about 3 years ago. And that was with the kind of task to do a turnaround on the institution. And it was a turnaround on all aspects of the institutional DNA, you can say. It was to give a more clear artistic vision for for the institution. It was to create a solid organization and also to consolidate the finances of the institution, its economy, which were extremely challenged. So it was a huge task. But of course, I find it also extremely motivating because it was this opportunity to try something new. I think one of my mottos after this experience is, you know, don't waste a good crisis. Because of course, there's a lot of challenges. Yeah. There's a lot of things that are extremely difficult in such situations where an institution is really hurting in all aspects of its institutional life. But I think it also gives you the mandate to really do something different, to do something new, to test out ideas. So that's what we've been doing for the past 3 years.
I just thought it was so interesting when you talk about a museum being like a ship and, you know, it just turns slowly. And I just think about your museum, beautifully designed by Søren Robert Lund. And it's like a ship, right? And it kind of fits within the landscape. And so I hadn't really thought about the metaphor of museums being like ships. But it's nice to think about it also that we as visitors and communities are part of that journey. So you came at this time, and I think from what I've seen and your current and forthcoming exhibitions, and you're coming up to the 30th anniversary, you really address a lot of the things that I wanted to ask you about, like the museum as a public space. Maybe if you could go into a little bit more about that and how you're integrating it with civic life. I remember you talked about the Tate there, and Chris Durkin was saying to me, you know, they have these surveys about what visitors appreciate and what museums do well. People, he told them, they came for an experience. The art is part of it, but it's actually experience and a place for encounter, right? And museums do that very well in a unique way than any other institutions, I think. So tell us what your thinking is behind the different public engagements and what you're doing at Aachen.
No, but absolutely. I think there's been many surveys on that one of the primarily motivations for people to visit museums is the social interaction, the social context. And I think we're learning as institutions that it's more and more important for us to create the best possible framework for that social engagement. You often go to museums with other people, friends, family, but also if you even go by yourself, the notion of being with others in a form of a collective experience on the day that you're there, even though if you don't speak directly or interact, but something about having those meeting places, which I think are extremely important, and even more so in these days where public space is lacking. You know, we're getting less and less really public space. Things are privatized. We need to insist on spaces where we can meet. And I think especially museums have a really great ability to be these meeting places, because art is not about a right and wrong. It's not about, there's no facts. It's a place where we can really kind of challenge the notions of society, of existential thematics, of being in the world. That's what artists do every day. They give us different takings on what it means to be a human being, of what it means to be in a part of the society in which we live at a certain time. And I think our greatest task is to give the audiences that experience, that there are other people out there, artists, who give some different ideas and different takings on something that involves every one of us. So at Aachen, we try to be that civic space in different ways. We try to be it in the way we work with artists, that we've started when I came on board to do large-scale commissions or site-specific or site-responsive exhibitions, where we offer them, we have this very big space. It's the longest exhibition space in Denmark of about 150 meters. And it's a bit difficult because, as you say, our museum is shaped like a ship. So it kind of bends all the way down on one end. So it looks like this underbelly of a big container ship. So it's a challenging space. But we can also sense that for the artist to get that opportunity to create something, especially for that space, challenges their practice, maybe even gives them the possibility of realizing projects they wouldn't be able to do elsewhere. So I think that collaboration with artists are quite important to us, because we know that the audience also creates that experience of artists being responsive to the world in which they work and live, and gives them that different experience each time they hear. So they really get a sense of the different medias and expressions and representation of what is going on artistically at the moment. Then we work a lot with hospitality. how, as a museum, can we be good hosts to our guests? And it might seem like an easy thing, but it's not, because we also have an institutional culture that has been cultivated over 100 years. There's these certain ideas about what it's like to visit a museum, how one should behave. And this is not something only coming from the audience. It's from the institution itself. We produce those ways of being every day. So we speak a lot about how can our guards or our hosts act in a different way, so we're more accommodating also for the audiences who are not necessarily brought up visiting art institutions. Because it's also important to say that Arkin is placed in a specific Danish demography, in the sense that we are outside of Copenhagen, but we're on the south side. So we serve about 450,000 people in 9 different municipalities. And they're very different. They're different in social income. They're different in ethnicities. So we have to kind of serve that entire audience, which is really diverse. But we are also very realistic about the fact that a lot of the local people we want to engage are not familiar with Arkin or any museum. So we really work. That's why I say hospitality is important on a deeper level. It's not just about, you know, being nice when you buy the ticket. It's also what kind of food do we serve? What kind of activities do we offer? How do we mediate? How do we write our wall texts? So it's really something that we try to get into the DNA of the institution, that we have this obligation to meet a diverse audience. And then there's the last part, which is being the good neighbor. That, you know, I attended this director's forum in Chicago this spring, and a lot of the conversation in terms of community work was this idea of being a good neighbor as an institution, that we are not just an institution placed, you know, somewhere. We're also a neighbor to the people that live around us. And how can we act as good neighbors in terms of providing a space that might not be present anywhere else in that neighborhood? And that is something we especially work a lot with when it comes to our youth engagement projects, because we can see that a lot of young people in our community don't really have hangout spaces or places to go after school. There's the mall, or, you know, after COVID, it's been difficult. We can also hear from the different that are around here that work with youth engagement to get the kids back and to get them engaged in activities together. So that's definitely something that we work with a lot.
Yeah, and it's great you also have this educational engagement, because I think that that's really important going forward, that kind of embodied learning. And we know that AI is changing. This is something I want to talk about later on in the conversation, is changing the way students are learning. So it's good to get them involved. So it's not all screens, but it's also not all done for you via AI, which is another kind of risk that young people are more dependent on that. Our education initiative has the participation of over 100 universities. So we are very much into these kind of experiences. So to talk about another thing that's also dear to our heart here at Creative Process and One Planet Podcast, which we've done hundreds of interviews about, and exhibitions too, we've done about the environment, is that your latest, one of your current exhibitions is with French artist Marguerite Humeau, at Torches. And so this is Nature Future. It's really, tell us about it, but I really love the concepts and some of the questions she asks. What if humans would become collective beings? So that's kind of, it's like on the edge of the future, like thinking about AI and the collective intelligence. But then, you know, that would be a kind of, maybe it's an ideal, because I've often looked at the intelligence of plants and trees and the coral reefs. In some ways, they're more advanced than we are. If we could become like that, attempting to synchronize with all life forms, what if elephants had become the dominant species on Earth? We're so used to being on top, dominating all. But this is really visual experience. It's also auditory. It also is kind of breaking boundaries and way post-disciplinary art, science, history. So tell us a little bit more about that, because I really love these kind of exhibitions that make us feel, but also make us think.
Mm-hmm. Marguerite's exhibition is the last in a trilogy that we initiated in 23, which we call Nature Future. And it was based on the idea of letting artists investigate this relationship between man, nature, and technology, which is, you know, we're in a time where this is being investigated all the time and extremely complicated. And how do we embrace technology at the same time as we insist on being connected to the physical nature and having that connectedness, which we can also all sense, which is extremely important for us humans. So we asked the different artists to engage with the thematic. So the first we showed in 23 was Refik Anadol, this Turkish who works with IA and who investigates it very from kind of a, you can say, positive way of interacting with technology, you know, kind of with the machine. If we as humans into this encounter with technology, how can we use it in a positive way to maybe expand the way we can see the world? So we try to give us a little bit of, you can say, hope in terms of this meeting between man and technology, where he also insists that there is actually a potential in this relationship which might be able to bring us forward and might be able to actually take more care of our natural environment. The second exhibition we did was with Julien Cherrière, the Swiss artist, who also is extremely dedicated to the natural world and his work, and also investigates our relationship, both how we as humans have, of course, used the natural resources in a way which challenges us today and the future of the planet. And we built an entire garden in the museum and filled it with dirt and had these beautiful plants growing. And now we have Marguerite's exhibition Torches, which is really a beautiful exhibition, which is this opera in five acts, because she also uses sound, light, sculpture. So it is really this total installation, this Gesamtkunstwerk that we're entering when we get into the space. And she also does this speculation about what will the world look like when we humans are not there anymore? What types of species will then be present? And she draws these lines between an ancient past. You know, she was very inspired by cave paintings when she did this exhibition, from the ancient past to an indefinite future. So she's really also creating something that is out of time, in the sense that she really makes us think about this glacial time, that maybe humans are just here for a very, very short period of a global time span, which is extremely interesting. And as she says, she's very involved with these animals and creatures who work collectively, bees and ants, microbes, that have this collective, this synergy and this collective consciousness that makes them create beautiful, beautiful things. And maybe there's something to be learned for us humans from these type of animals. So it's, again, having this, I think that's also one of the you know, what is so important with art, that it gives us this speculative space. We don't need to find an end solution, but it's a space where we can speculate, we can imagine, we can practice our foresight. We can be part of a bigger collective imagination together with an institutional framework, which is really what we try to motivate as well when we communicate these exhibitions to our audience and speak with our guests about these works. We can also sense that it's really a place where a lot of people like to enter these days. You know, when you turn on the TV or look at a newspaper, or listen to your radio and speak with your friends, it seems like the world is falling apart on so many levels. It's such a challenging time. So I think we can also offer this space for reflection, but also hopefully a reflection that gives some idea or some feeling of agency. Because I think that is one of the places that we are really challenged, also when we speak to kids and young people, that they don't feel they have any agency in creating a better future for themselves. So I think we can really give that space to our audiences by showing some of these groundbreaking practices that are out there right now in contemporary art.
Yes, it's true. And I think that's one thing that the arts and humanities broadly help us understand, these moments of crisis that we are experiencing. It's no doubt that we are in a crucial decade, but the arts and humanities, I think, give us that perspective. And then to understand through the arc of history, things like this, not quite like this, but we've been through other crises, and you can find beauty in the crisis, and we can put a frame around it and have that reflective moment. I love exhibitions, and I've long been a fan of Marguerite Dumont's work, but also these exhibitions that help us reflect on that arc of time. I'm kind of obsessed at the moment. We had him on our show, the paleoanthropologist and author of The Last Neanderthal and The Naked Neanderthal, Ludovic Slimak. He was discussing, I didn't think I personally had much in common with the Neanderthals, but this is what he studies, these cave projects, excavations. And as he writes, it also is relevant to our times now as we go into this new frontier. We look at AI, and apparently we have these preconceptions about Neanderthals, and we said they were slow or whatever, but apparently they were artistic. He examined their tools and saw that they were all like art objects. Each one was different and really creative, and they were intelligent. They weren't the way we've kind of told the story about Neanderthals now. The beginnings, the Homo sapiens, who became dominant, were just a bit faster. So if you look at their tools, they're all the same. Already it was almost an industrial process. They didn't have variations. They weren't respecting the form of the rock or the flint or whatever that they were carving. They just were already making this kind of efficient, maybe faster industrial tool. And so he likens that to us being on this new AI frontier where we're maybe the Neanderthals of today. It's all coming down. And the thing is, to remind ourselves, because this is what happens with the generations, when young people see there's something faster and maybe better, they abandoned their humanity or the old ways of doing for what's shiny and new. So we have to remember that and to think, will we go the way of the Neanderthals or will we author our own future? So that's just something that's kind of scary, but kind of poetic in its own way.
Yeah, definitely.
So that's the future with perhaps without humans, but I don't want to believe it's a foregone conclusion. So you mentioned there, you know, exhibitions that incorporate sound, and I also know beyond that you've brought new formats into the museum like silent discos and concerts, and these are all other ways to appreciate the art and allow it to resonate with people who are attracted to that kind of sonic way of understanding and feeling. I find it so interesting the way music can give us a new perspective or a way into contemplating the art. So tell us a little bit more about some of those other community engagement ways of enjoying the museum space.
Yeah, for us, it's been quite important for the past 3 years to open up the institution, to make a clear signal to the world around us that Arkin, we welcome everyone who wants to visit, because we really want to show that the museum can be the framework for multiple experiences. And again, we're located in this beautiful natural area. It's like a small journey out into the nature, out by the beach, we're by the sea. So we're not a museum that you choose on your way home from work or that you trip over on your way through doing your Sunday shopping. It's really like a dedicated decision to go to Arkin. So it's imperative for us to open the doors up even wider and also show that, you know, this museum can host multiple experiences. And to be honest, sometimes where the critique of museums taking in other forms of entertainment, music, concerts, social gatherings in different formats, I'm kind of wondering why we have this reluctance to do so in museums, because again, the framework of the museum is something that we build ourselves. It's a cultural construction. And today, working with contemporary art, I'm every day presented with how closely contemporary art is working with other creative areas. There's cross-disciplinarity and beautiful, and artists today are cross-disciplinary in the sense that if you ask, are you a painter or a sculptor, they will say, yes, I'm a painter and a sculptor, and I also do performance, and then I work with a musician, and I have a beautiful friend who's a scientist who infuse my work, and I work with this university. And so there's an extreme curiosity in contemporary art these days that I think we should have as institutions as well. So we don't limit ourselves to do traditional shows. Of course, we do what you could call traditional exhibitions as well. But if we can be a place where people also come to enjoy themselves, to meet, to have conversations, to have a drink, to listen to some music, that's absolutely fine. we had this wonderful experience when we had our first public openings, because before the openings, which is the same in a lot of institutions, are these VIP openings. You invite the people who always come because they're part of society, and you know, they come and we eat this fine dinner and you do some speeches and everything is fine. But the problem is then you never get the broader audience to see, be a part of that festive event that an opening can be. So we began having these openings where everybody was welcome. We had some DJs to also, of course, to create a party. Again, hospitality. We're super proud of this beautiful work the artist has done. Let's throw a party for them. And we also put buses from Copenhagen that could take the audiences to Arken, because we know there's kind of a last mile challenge in terms of transportation. So we did a lot of things to have people coming. And we had about 3,000 people for our first big opening. And the most fantastic thing was that I was in one of the spaces that evening and I looked around and I didn't know one single person. And that was amazing, because normally I know everyone at an opening. You know, it's the same crowd that keeps circling. So that fantastic experience of really having brought in a younger also audience. I had this mother writing to me the day after that her 15-year-old son was there, had been there with his friends. And now he came home and he wanted to bring his parents and his friends to show the museum. So he became an ambassador by being at our opening one night. Maybe he didn't see all the art, and it doesn't matter, but he wanted to come back. So that this pride that he came home with being, I visited Arken, it was great, it was cool. I didn't know a museum could be like that. If we can do that for a couple of young people, you know, fantastic.
I think these are the collectors of the future. I think that the young collectors are very democratic and they're even buying work online. And the auction houses are open to that. And so we've seen them transform themselves. So I think that we are seeing a lot of change, and I think that can only continue. And it's interesting that you should say it's kind of thrilling when you, it's not just the usual suspects who show up, but it's really engaging with the wider community. And that's, I think, the sign of the social relevance. So you can reach people, the ripple effect can be so much wider than you can ever measure. And so I think we have to be open with it. We have to adapt, evolve, or be replaced by something else that's adaptive. Because that's the other thing I think about. And I think adaptive intelligence is maybe even more important. I'm glad you're doing that at Arken. And talking about anniversaries and momentous years, next year Arken is celebrating its 30th year. And you've said that Arken will be turning the ship in a more Nordic direction to offer something international, but also something distinct from other international institutions. So how do you approach that with your curatorial vision? And what is the artistic voice of the Nordic region? As I know, it's also very globalized, but how do you see that?
That's a good question. I think what's important for us, and we've discussed that a lot in the curatorial team and in the museum organization, is what does it mean to be international today? Because I remember when I started in the museum world 20 years ago, at least in a Danish context, international was everything not related to Denmark or the Nordics. Everybody was looking to New York, to London, to Paris, somewhere outside of Denmark. Every museum had to have a Rauschenberg if they had a modern collection, or an Andy Warhol, this type of mimicking of the great international museums. Also, at that time, a lot of new museums were being built. You had the Tate Modern, Bilbao, before that. There was also these very kind of flagship museums, really kind of profiling the institutional world. So I think in Denmark, we lost a lot of energy of looking outside our own kind of region. But also it was a point in time when artists left Denmark. They all went to Berlin because it was cheap. There were space to do artistic practices. Or they went to London, New York, somewhere else to be inspired, to find artistic communities, because we were not growing them in Denmark. So I think that time is different now. I think it's a consequence of global politics, of course, that there is a new interest in the Nordics, in our welfare model, or how we structure our societies. Of course, also because we're kind of caught in discussions around global power positioning and everything at the moment. So there's this renewed political interest also locally or regionally in the Nordics. But we can also sense that over the last decade or so, a lot of international attention has been on how it is to live in the Nordic countries. There's this high quality of life, work-life balance. You know, we have an international attraction. Our food scene has been, for years, had extreme international attention. And I think that's finding its way to the arts as well, visual arts, where we have a flourishing artistic community, at least in Denmark. But I think the Nordic countries sense the same, that fewer artists are leaving the country. They're actually staying, growing, also new grassroots initiatives, artist-run spaces, all the things that we didn't have as plenty as we have it now. And I also, when I often have international groups come from all over the world and I show them around the museum, and of course they're happy to see a Rauschenberg or an Andy Warhol. I mean, we don't have any in our collection, but they're happy to see artists they know. But what they really want to see is, where's the local art? Where's the Danish talents? Where's the Nordic talents? What are artists interested in your region? So we can also sense actually an institutional urgency in bringing forth all of these fantastic artists that come out of the Nordic region in these years. So this is definitely something that we'll focus on and have been for the past years, but even more so next year when we turn 30. We're kind of doing a programming where it could as well have been done in 1996, where we opened. We're doing a big Superflex exhibition, which of course now there are very well-founded, international-oriented artist trio from Denmark. But in 96, they were brand new emerging artists. So it's kind of fun to think about, we could have done the show we do next year in 96, but of course it would have been a different time. And I think if you see, it's really difficult for me to give you like a headline on the special Nordic sensibility or how are the artists, you know, do have like a common ground in sense of, I think actually there's different practices going on, media is being explored. I think what is important is that we as institutions still have quite a lot of freedom to investigate all different types of artistic practices, that we still have that arm's length between the funding from the government and our institutional programmings. And I think that is something that we need to value, we need to nurture, because we see in Western democracies elsewhere that this is being challenged, where the governments are to a higher and higher degree interested in the programming of institutions, in the artistic freedom. So I think there's something in the Nordics where we'll be protective of that artistic freedom for a longer time than maybe other countries, because it's such a fundamental part of Nordic democracies and the welfare state. But that is also under pressure from the welfare state. Danish welfare state is part of a global economics today, so it can't shield itself off from everything that is happening in the world. So of course, these things are also eroding and shifting. So that's also a very interesting time for us to, through the art and the artistic, in a way of looking at what's happening, to bring that forth to our audience and have those discussions.
I did want to say, yeah, it's really interesting, the questions of whether a country or a region can have a national character. I think I notice it more in writing, where I feel like the grammar and the language can't change, whereas visual art images can be perhaps more quickly metabolized by the world and shared. But there's something you almost can't change about language and grammar. So I feel like I can really recognize Danish or Nordic writing. There's a certain philosophical element. There is a particular brand of existentialism and a relationship to nature and the natural world that I feel that's instantly recognizable. And sometimes I feel that with certain visual artists, but it's a little bit more outward looking in ways that language has to be. Of where you're from, you just, you know, it's like you can't get rid of your accent almost. But that's what I feel, and I have a great fondness for those, like, you know, those writers and those artists. So the Superflex exhibition, so is this truly part of the collabs that you're having? How does that really work? I mean, are there any challenges, you know, just practically, or how you like build trust with artists or artist groups when you're kind of creating work specifically for the site and collabing?
I think it's something that is very hard to put on a formula. It's something that we always work closely with the respective artists and how to do it. We often invite artists on the basis of an idea we have, not for the exhibition, but how we would like to have the impact of the exhibition. Is it important for us that it's something that can reach a broader audience, that maybe highlights some of the issues that we know is deeply rooted within the artistic practice of a certain artist? But we always let the artists come with the ideas of what they would like to do. Because that's also the ever amazing thing is, as a curator, you can have so many ideas on how a show would look like with a certain artist, but the artist will always challenge you in a different type of work than you anticipated, or that site responsiveness that you really can't foresee how that will be formulated in the words of an artist. So we always try to be quite open in our invitations to artists without having specific works outlined for the exhibition, but to really engage them in a conversation on, are there any projects that you think could be created in this space that you haven't been able to create before? Or is there a new idea that you would like to investigate? So we try to go on that journey with them and help them in establishing the means to do so. Of course, that's financially. It's also what's possible physically within the spaces. We have big spaces, but there can be limits to what we can do in terms. But I will say we go to great length of trying to fit the projects that the artists would like to do to our institutional framework. You know, we've dig up our concrete floor many times. We've put in a forest or a garden. We've had water, like thousands and thousands of liters of water in our space. And we really try to also challenge the institution itself and the way we do things by being open. But of course, there's always limits of budget and other kind of practicalities.
I'm Jamie Lammers. I really connected with Marie's discussion of connecting with an actual physical space, being able to take in everything that's surrounding you in the moment. As a kid, I absolutely adored nature, and a large part of that was because of a local nature center that I went to mainly during the summer, but pretty much the entire year for many years. Either we would complete activities in the physical nature center building, or we would actually go out and walk the trails of my home state of Colorado. I fell in love with the natural world. And in recent years, I felt like I've lost that connection to nature until this past summer when I started walking on trails again. I found an excuse to go out and walk on trails in the Colorado area again. So I think there's something to be said about connecting with a genuine physical space, whether that space is an art museum that allows you to interact with your surroundings, an art museum that allows you to just take them in so you can reflect, a nature center like the one I went to, an open field or sanctuary or trail, or any environment that allows you to interact directly with what you're experiencing and allow you to take in the moment. Marie emphasized it beautifully when she talked about turning on the television or looking at the newspaper or listening to the radio and seeming like everything around you is falling apart, when the truth is, that's not the entirety of the world. We're seeing everything through a small perspective, a lens of what is given to us on our daily news feeds on our phones, on the news stations on our TVs or on our radios, on the news articles and headlines on our newspapers, or even the stories that we hear amongst our friends. It's more important than ever to find ways now to get out of that technology bubble that we find ourselves falling more and more into as society continues to develop. It's more important now than ever to find spaces where we can just take a few moments to recenter and reconnect. Now back to the interview.
So speaking of other limitations, certain other countries have America has recently closed its scope. And you're not the only institution to be affected by this. Due to the political agenda, President Trump and the Smithsonian have withdrawn from, you had a nature project. Tell us a little bit about that. And you now have a new partner, the Phillips Collection. You're not the only museum or cultural institution. There are many who've had their plans derailed by the limited scope of the Trump administration.
We initiated a collaboration with the Smithsonian last year on this project called Future Worlds, which is about engaging young people in working with artists who are engaged with nature in one way or the other in their practices. Because a survey shows that about a bit over 30% of both actual Danish and American teenagers have a hard time envisioning a positive future. Of course, part of that is due primarily, according to the survey, to the global climate crisis. So they feel powerless. And luckily, a lot of artists are quite interested in working with giving back that agency to society and engaging young people in that work with nature. We can also see in Denmark that the kids are, you know, their vocabulary is diminishing, or they have less words to describe nature and the cycle of nature, which of course also means that when you don't have the words to speak about it, you don't have that understanding, you don't have that knowledge. Of course, it's also a consequence of our screen-based world. So this is something we really wanted to investigate across the Atlantic, because we have different local conditions for working with nature, but there are some things that we're quite experienced on in Denmark, which is this very interactive and engaging mediation and working together with young people. Whereas in the US, they're much more experienced with engaging with a more diverse audience. So we could learn a lot from them and how they really integrate a diverse audience into their programmings. So there would be a great synergy and a great exchange to be made here. But as you said, that has been challenged by the current political situation in the US. Luckily, some of the good people who we work with at the Smithsonian have transferred to the Phillips Collection, who has agreed to continue the collaboration, which is fantastic. We still hope there's an opportunity for the Smithsonian to be part of it, because they were part of developing this project. But hopefully that will continue over the next years in Washington as well as in Copenhagen and Israel.
Yeah, I think that as much as we talk about a national character of artists, you see certain trends. I don't believe that museums should be nationalistic or propagandistic. And that's what we've kind of seen a tendency or nudging towards, not from the institutions themselves, but it just passes down the policy. And that's unfortunate. You've worked with some really amazing artists. You talked about light and space, and continuing on from that, you've worked with artists James Turrell and Doug Wheeler and Oliver Eliasson, you know, who create, this is about that experience. It's not an object per se, but they open our eyes. It can be transcendental. It can offer something fleeting. What attracts you to these kind of artists that reflects kind of what we are experiencing also in our digital lives and our screen-based worlds? It's kind of interesting, kind of opens the spectrum, but also reflects the technology as well.
Yeah, because what is important to remember when you think about the works, big immersive, you know, beautiful light installations of James Turrell and Douglas Wheeler and so on, they come from a time in the 60s where, a little similar as to where we now, you had political revolts, you had wars going on in the other end of the world from a US perspective, you had technology booming. So a lot of things, it was really also a tumultuous world where things were changing quite rapidly. So a lot of these artists really took their point of departure in this technological revolution, but they also used it to provide or give us a way to experience as well, in a sensory one, because I think you can lose track of your senses, of your body, of you being in the world, that groundedness in a world that is so challenging and filled with crisis as the one we're in now. I think those types of work can give you that bodily based experience where you also enter a space that lies beyond the actual reality. Think of Malevich, who under the Russian Revolution in 1917 was painting his abstract paintings of black on black. He was sitting there with this war around him, and he just escaped into this minimalistic abstract reality. And I think it can also be an expression or a consequence of a world that is extremely hard to be in and to deal with, where impulses are coming to you every day. To have an artistic experience where that actual world is left for a moment or two and you step into something else, again, a room of potential, which can also be subversive in the sense that it can give you agency, if you can reconnect yourself with your body and with the world, I think is extremely interesting and important, and maybe something that a lot of us need in times of crisis.
Yeah, and so as you reflect on the importance of the arts, you talk about reminding us of our human nature, of social issues. I mean, what for you at the core is, I guess I should ask you about your personal journey, you know, what drew you to the arts and what's the importance of the arts and what has it given you in your life?
I think for me, it's this awe that I have every time I meet an artist who has the courage to deal with what it means to be in the world as a human being and to tackle from different ways, through different media. I always feel that through the collaborations I have with artists, I learn a little bit more about the world, about myself, about my feelings or emotions or how I reflect about things. Getting another person's perspective, taking that in. I think it's extremely generous, actually, what we can take with us from the artistic practices that we meet. And again, I think one of the fundamental importance about art is that it's not a place where we need to agree or find consensus or have rules. It's a place where we can speculate, where we can imagine, and hopefully re-courage ourselves in a way, if that's a word. But yeah, I'm always motivated by working with artists. It's that personal meet that's always extremely fruitful.
Oh, well, as an artist, it's so nice to hear that. But I also have been re-couraged or re-energized by people behind the scenes. I've always called them the invisible arts. I think that they're very much woven together. It's something essential because the production of art, you're the producers, the curators, the museum directors. Art wouldn't be seen. It might not ever escape the studio without those are the scaffolding. We can't do anything without a foundation and scaffolding. And so I've always learned a lot. There's a kind of perspective and logic, but also curators help me understand what's happening in the art, what's happening in the films and the books and the theater. So I think it's also linked with teaching. I think the curation and making museum exhibitions is also linked to the art of teaching. I find it's invaluable because sometimes, let's be honest, some artists are articulate about their art and others kind of put all their energy into the art making and they need translators, cultural translators. So I think that it's hand in hand and essential. Yeah. In our exhibitions, there's always a space for honoring the teachers, the behind the scenes people, the producers, because, you know, it's always the top name. In every profession, there's cinematographers you didn't think about. There's film editors you didn't think about.
Definitely. And I think sometimes the artists appreciate that collaboration that you have as a curator or any other staff involved in an exhibition. We have exhibition designers and our department builds the exhibitions and they have so much knowledge that the artists are often inspired by and makes them adjust projects because they interact with the other human being who has an expertise in another field. So I think it's really about, we try to have this, you know, we're all in team spirit about this is a collective project. Of course, we do this for the artist, but we do it with the artist as well. It's the effort of many people every time we open a show. It's not just the artist, it's not just the curator. It's really a team effort. And that pride that we can see that it gives everybody involved, it's just fantastic. It's a little bit like Marguerite Humeau's bees, you know, for a certain amount of time, we all work together to create this beautiful structure that we present to the world, which is an exhibition or a work.
It's just true. Even a painting, sometimes if it's not lit, you just don't really see it. You need that. So I think that every art form, even those that we consider more solitary, like painting, everything comes about through conversation. There's something that sparked it, and it's not just sitting alone in your room, because that wouldn't be very interesting. Speaking about current exhibitions, you really get us to think about all kinds of things. You have an exhibition, Goddammit, by Kenneth Rasmussen. And he asks important questions like where and when do we fit into society's norms and what does creativity mean in society full of systems, digitalization and consideration for the majority. Tell us a little bit about Kenneth Rasmussen and this kind of movement of inclusivity and perspective that work is inviting from visitors.
Yeah, and his exhibition is a really new, interesting step for us as well, because Kenneth Rasmussen is not an artist in the traditional sense that he was educated at the Art Academy and, you know, has this long institutional history. Actually, he's not exhibited in institutions that much before, but he is what you can call kind of an outsider artist who every day works in this protected workshop in a city in Jutland called Ranas. And together with his fellow residents there, they create art from this very impulsive, meaningful creativity that they all have within them. And for Kenneth, it's really a way of managing the world. So he's extremely refreshing in the sense that he doesn't really care about the conventions of diplomacy and pragmatism. And he's very daring. And if he doesn't like the municipality, he says, well, the goddamn municipality. And he says, fuck alcohol. And all of these things, you know, if he's angry at something, he lets it know through his art. So it's definitely also something that is for him therapeutic in a way of him being in the world. But it's extremely interesting also from an institutional point of view, because it's also important for us to be able to absorb artists that are working outside of the established system. I think it's not something we've done a lot of in Denmark. We have Overtashi, which is another outsider artist that has been quite promoted. But otherwise, we don't really work with contemporary artists that are our set of artists. So for us, it's very exciting to present the work of Kenneth. And he makes these extremely immersive knitted works where he knits, but he knits from plastic. So, you know, visualize Kenneth sitting in a chair for years, just taking these plastic bags and making them into threads and then knitting them together to create these big webs of knitted plastic. And they're absolutely breathtaking, beautiful, at the same time as there are these immersive installations, like in Estoneto-like environments that you walk into. For Kenneth, I think it's really survival that he has his art and that it's really an output for him in a way of him being able to speak about issues that concern him. And he also makes these beautiful drawings that we'll be showing. So that kind of spontaneous and really deep-felt creativity that he brings is absolutely inspiring.
Yeah, and I see a thread now to another forthcoming exhibition that you'll have is Chameleon by Monira Al-Qadiri. And talking about plastics or knitting, I see that exhibition thinks to a future in the aftermath of oil. So we're talking about when we will have no plastics. What if dinosaurs fossilized in petroleum millions of years ago began singing back to us? This is quite interesting. There's this theme of the song that travels across history. What are we doing now and how will that echo on in the future for future generations? What stories will we tell in the aftermath of oil? It's kind of weird. You know, when I think about plastics, we use them every day, unfortunately still. But when you think about it, it is the remains. It's basically the corpses, the melted, boiled down, pressure cooked remains of those fossils, those animals in the past. So it's kind of, it's creepy, actually.
Yeah, it's the future of archaeology is plastic.
Yeah, but that's what remains. When you think about, because we've done interviews about this, what are the future fossils? And what will they tell? What will we say about ourselves? We built all these roads. I think you can see roads from space. We left a lot of plastic. We left a lot of carbon in the atmosphere. But it's funny to think about what those future generations will intuit about us. And is the story that we're now writing about who we are and what we believe in and what we value, what we really want to leave as our legacy as well.
It's so interesting to having this young artist from Kuwait who really kind of experienced the transition from the traditional Kuwaitian society, you can say, and then to the discovery of oil. Of course, not herself, she's too young, but from her parents' generation, it was an extreme discovery that changed the entire society of a region and a country. And Munia says, I'm a post-oil baby. She's not post-internet, that doesn't matter anymore, but she's post-oil. And of course, with that, she comments on a whole generation of especially maybe a Middle Eastern youth who don't remember how things were before extreme wealth and the oil. But she said, well, my grandparents' house, if it rained, it would fall together, you know, because it was clay. They would have to be built it, and they were fishing for pearls and had these songs, this cultural tradition. And of course, there's a certain regret that a lot of this has been lost in this transition to extreme wealth. And of course, it's also her way of commenting on what is it that we leave for the future. The oil industry hasn't just impacted on the extraction of oil itself. It's also the way we carry the oil around across the sea in the entire world. It's the way we refine the oil. It has invaded our bodies and everything we use and wear. So it's almost like a pandemic, something that has really affected us all without us really noticing it, maybe, if we weren't in these countries where this extreme wealth all of a sudden came to everyone. And she does it in an interesting, intelligent way, where she creates these beautiful, very alluring works that looks like, you know, big balloons and pop artish sculptures, but it's all molecules from the oil that she blows up, or it's these drill heads that she turns into these beautiful sculptures. So I think she does it in an extremely intelligent, this critique that of course is embedded in her work, but she nuances the discussion by also making it something that we can't help but being fascinated about and attracted to. So I'm really looking forward to seeing her show at Arkin.
Yeah, and so I'm piecing together the different threads and, of course, where Arkin is situated. I always felt there's a story about landscape, the local story, and in this kind of reverence for nature as well, as I see in some of your exhibitions. How do you feel where you were born and raised and its landscape? How does that inspire exhibitions you're putting on and your perspective on the world? I mean, are there memories of nature? How has that imprinted itself on you?
I think almost everyone in Denmark lives close to the sea because we have sea all around. And we have this peninsula and then the two islands, which makes out primary part of Denmark. So I think the sea has always been a part of me, and something also which was really interesting for me to reconnect to when I came to Arkin, because we're just close by the sea. And as we talked about, have this metaphor around a ship and the ark in the museum. So now, and also with the discussion on the climate crisis and the rise of the sea waters, this is something that, at least for me, has a groundedness in some of my experience from childhood and always being by the sea every day. And I do think in Denmark, we do have a connectedness to nature because we're also a farming country. So nature has also been historically what has provided us with food. But we have a very pastoral nature, as Doc Aitken, the American artist, once said to me. We don't have the spectacular mountains or fjords if you go to Norway or Sweden. We're a bit more kind of flat country. But I think that's also giving us this connected to nature, but also nature as something that has been important for us in terms of food and providing for the families. So for me, the sea is something that has always resonated with me, because as a child, I fell to sleep every night with the sound of the sea coming through my window. And I have this other amazing experience, which is I've always been fascinated with deserts, which is absolutely nothing. We don't have any deserts in Denmark. But I think coming from this small country where you can drive across country in 3 hours, it's tiny Denmark. Coming to the US for the first time, visiting the American desert. I've also been in the Middle East visiting deserts in Iran and Syria. And these vast landscapes, these monumental vast landscapes, I think they're absolutely amazing. And I'm sure their impact on me also has something to do with the fact that I'm always fascinated by artists who does these large scale things. Things that, well, your body just becomes scale-wise small, you know, where something is greater than you in a way. I think that experience of endless, monumental, sublime nature is something that I can relive through certain artistic experiences sometimes.
It's so interesting. I also have always been inspired by the sea. And I think also when you talk about the attraction to desert, the sand, it's almost like the absence of water. It's the memory of water. It's like walking on the bottom of the ocean and the ocean has been removed. So that's what it looks like. Now you can walk on the bottom of the ocean, but it's gone. But the ripples, it's exactly there. That's exactly what it looks like. And so I think that it makes us reflect on that. And reflect on, gosh, I want to need water. It makes you, it draws you back to the water.
Definitely.
It gives you that thirst, they say, the spiritual thirst, or certain number of religions were born in the desert. It's something about it makes you value the preciousness of life and water. And you spoke there also about learning from artists and then different artists thinking about their generations before and how they learned from that or how they're building upon those stories. And how do you feel your upbringing, your family or your teachers, did they guide you on this path towards art? Or what did you learn from them that like you always remember?
Yeah, I think we all stand on the shoulders of people who've inspired us and taught us. I think especially for me, when it comes to the art, it was my mother, who was a cultural journalist, who's always been extremely interested in art and wrote about art. And she was in the newspaper. And later she did TV, also often about artistic projects. And my parents moved me to Paris when I was 8, and we lived there for a couple of years. And I remember going with my mother and father to Centre Pompidou in the evening and watching a performance by Yoko Ono, who was basically screaming for an hour or so. That's how I remember it. And I remember looking at all of these adults around me who were like, And I was like, what is this? You know, so intrigued by all of these people being fascinated by, you know, this performance. And me too, in a way, because I was like, how is she allowed to stand there and scream when I'm not allowed to scream 5 minutes at home? You know, so there was this, childish meeting with this avant-garde, well, for me, art world in Paris, which was extremely influential, I can see now. And that curiosity, you know, that my parents also had. I remember going to a huge Boyce show, seeing his revolutionary piano and wanted to play it. And these materials he was working as the felt and the fat. And I still remember that exhibition today. And it's quite some years ago. So I remember these early experiences of visiting exhibitions and seeing artists and meeting them through my mother. Also speaking with them, being really fascinated about these people who dare to send out all of these artworks into the world. It's also an extreme vulnerability in some way. I still remember seeing my first Mark Rothko painting in Paris, which was a huge experience. I was like, what is this sea of color and this infinite space for reflection that this artist offers me? So yeah, it's definitely from my childhood. And then I think if I should mention kind of one, I've never really been very interested in a curatorial tradition or history, and you know, but I've learned a lot from the people who I've worked with through the years, my colleagues, my managers, especially the director at Aris, where I worked for many years. And he was like a director of an old school, which would be more challenging today. But at the time, I had a huge respect for him because he pushed the limit and he didn't care. Every time he was critiqued, which he was quite often for doing too populistic shows, being too mainstream, he was one of the first to kind of pave the way of an engaging museum in the sense of thinking new exhibition formats. And he got so much critique for it. But I just remember him being like totally rock solid in that critique, saying, well, you can see the audience, you know, they're coming in tenfold. They have a fantastic experience. The museum and the experience we do are for them. You know, they're not for the art world only. And I don't know, I take a lot of his insistence of also trying out new ground, even though it means you sometimes also meet some critical voices or two.
Yeah, well, we have to have the power of our convictions. I guess quickly in closing, as you think about the future, the kind of world we're leaving for the next generation, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, I hope that young people can use, again, as I said, let's not waste a good crisis, that the crisis we're in globally today, they somewhere can find a motivation to say, well, then we'll do it in a different way. That they can insist on the imagination of the freedom of thought and artistic freedom to use that to move society in a better direction. And it's not necessarily forward. I think that's also something I wanted them to reflect about. You know, sometimes we see human development as a progression towards something better, but maybe it's not always forward. Maybe we need to go a little bit backward or sideways to find what is the future good solutions for society and for us humans. So I hope they will dare to experiment and also be able to forgive the mistakes that will be made and hopefully mend the polarization that I regrettably see happening today. So yeah, hopefully they'll learn from the bees and from the ants and that collectiveness that can really create an impact.
Yeah, well, that's really great advice. Don't waste a crisis. So thank you, Marie Nipper and Arkham Museum, for all you've done to push the boundaries of art, to celebrate Danish and Nordic art in the international art scene, examining technology, the natural world, and other important issues of our time. I think, you know, by helping us rethink the future of the museum as an artistic lab at the heart of our communities, you help us imagine and design a better tomorrow. So thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you for having me.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. The associate interview producers on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Jamie Lammers. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk with additional production support by Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, and podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram @creativeprocesspodcast and send us a DM. Thank you for listening.